Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, here in Wisconsin, we have lots of farmland, I think more than 14 million acres. And all of that soil has the potential to absorb carbon. And we'll talk with two guests about agriculture and the positive impact it can have on climate change, coming up right now, as a matter of fact. Joining us today, Corbett Granger. He is an associate professor of agriculture and applied economics at UW-Madison. Corbett, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Brian Van Stippen, our other guest, is the project director of the National Indian Carbon Coalition. And Brian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me today, Larry.
Well, great to have you both here. We're taking your questions as you listen to these two experts. We'll be talking carbon storage, policy, and farming. And maybe you're concerned about the level of carbon in our atmosphere. What do you think needs to happen to have it lowered? Join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Corbett, let's start with you, and maybe you could give us an overview. How does farming and food production contribute to climate change?
Well, in the U.S., about 10% of greenhouse gas emissions come from agriculture. If you look globally, that figure is quite a bit larger. It's about 25 to 30%. But it comes from a variety of sources. You know, the obvious one would be, you know, burning fossil fuels from tractors and other machinery. But there are a lot of other sources like nitrous oxide emissions, you know, that come from application of fertilizers or growing nitrogen-fixing crops, drainage of organic soils and irrigation. So we think that management of soil accounts for about half of the agricultural emissions in the U.S., and that's about 5% of U.S. total emissions.
Yeah. Brian, anything to add there?
No, I agree with Corbett's side. I mean, we see a lot of times in the agricultural industry on the emissions to produce our food sources are starting to become extremely high, and that's some of the things that we're trying to work on at the National Indian Carbon Coalition, specifically with indigenous populations, is how to offset or reduce those emissions through our agricultural practices on tribal lands.
Yeah, that's. Could you talk more about that coalition? How did it get started, and what's it been working on?
Certainly. So I am the program director for the National Indian Carbon Coalition, and it was created by the Indian Land Tenure Foundation, based out of Little Canada, Minnesota, as well as the Intertribal Agricultural Council, based out of Billings, Montana. And those two organizations have been working with tribal nations in the United States for about 50 years now as nonprofit entities. And we had seen a lot of for-profit developers trying to enter into Indian country to do carbon sequestration projects on tribal lands. So in about 2013, the National Indian Carbon Coalition was created to help educate tribes as to what these projects entailed, as well as help them step through the process of developing the data to determine whether or not if these projects would be viable on their tribal lands.
Interesting.
I was brought on board in 2017 after working as in-house counsel for some tribes in Wisconsin, and now I'm working in the nonprofit sector working with tribal nations in the lower 48, Alaska Native Villages Corporations, Native Hawaiian groups, and then First Nations in Canada. So we try to cover the entire indigenous populations of North America, servicing all of the populations there that we want to try to get in front of.
That's really interesting. You know, as I think about this, and you can probably both chime in here, but farming contributes to greenhouse gases, but we, you know, there's billions of people out there on the planet. We've got to eat. And one of the solutions is carbon storage. And maybe, I don't know, Corbett, do you want to start? What is carbon storage?
Well, carbon storage is just basically the kind of natural sequestration that we think of that, you know, when plants take up carbon. So if we look at land use and forestry in the U.S., for example, they're actually a net sink for carbon. So that sector actually reduces the total greenhouse gas emissions from the U.S. by about 12% per year. And the interesting thing here is that we could do much better. And part of doing better would include better practices in agriculture.
Yeah. And Brian, I know obviously Native Americans have been farming sustainably for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. What are some native farming practices that can be that could be adopted by any farmers?
Well, and some of the things that we look at, and I can give you a specific example of a tribe that we're working with in South Dakota, is a what we call avoided conversion of grassland to cropland. And what we see is that a lot of farmers anywhere in the United States want to plant more crops. And so we believe that that is a detriment to the environment. We want to keep those grasslands or prairie lands in their natural state. And so we have developed a project to focus on the development of carbon sequestration credits by focusing on that practice, and then as well as adding a no-till practice or a cover crop practice on the actual croplands themselves, which create additional carbon credits. So there's multiple different practices that any farmer can implement into their tribal or into their lands, whether it be tribal or non-tribal, that generate carbon credits.
And maybe we explain what carbon credits are.
So a carbon credit is considered to be one metric ton of greenhouse gases that would be sequestered into the ground, whether it be on a forest-based project or a soil-based project. We call soil-based projects grassland projects, grazing land, pasture land, or row crop land. So again, it's dependent upon the practice that is implemented into those lands itself. They can then generate a carbon credit, which can then obviously be sold for a monetary value.
Yeah, and Corbett, maybe you can talk about carbon markets. How do we measure success of programs like carbon credits or carbon markets?
Yeah, so this is, I think, to understand these carbon credits or to understand these offsets, we first need to kind of understand what a carbon market is. And so a carbon market is, it's sometimes called cap and trade or emissions trading, carbon trading. It's basically a market-based environmental regulation. The way that it works is we set an overall cap, and this is the total quota for emissions for the regulated sectors. And so you could think maybe we're regulating emissions from electric generation first, right? And so what we would do is allocate that total cap that we're setting on emissions from that sector to the regulated entities. So that would be individual power plants or electricity generating units. And then so each firm has some share of the overall cap. And then what happens is we allow that we allow these individual permits, so you can only emit if you have a permit, let's say for 1 ton, and we allow those permits to be bought and sold in a market. So we create a market where there wasn't a market before, and for emissions. And so the idea is you're only allowed to emit up to your own allowance, but if you allow individual firms to trade with one another, you create an incentive to make bigger reductions than you otherwise would, especially if you're a low-cost firm. If you can reduce your emissions a lot, you could sell your permits, make the reduction, sell those permits at a higher price than what it costs for you to reduce, and then you can profit off of it. So what we're trying to do here is create an incentive for individual firms to reduce their emissions. And the way that offsets come in or carbon credits come in is we can expand kind of the breadth of the policy by including sectors that aren't necessarily directly regulated. So even if agriculture is not directly regulated under a cap and trade program, if there are carbon credits that are generated and if they're verified, those credits can be sold as reductions to the firms that are making the that are regulated under the cap and trade program.
So let me turn back to you, Brian, then. Has the coalition been able to arrange that kind of process for its farmers?
Yes, we have developed a program which we call the Tribal Land Conservation Initiative. Currently, underneath that initiative, we have been working with 3 tribes in the United States. And those are going to be on lands that are forest-based. So those projects, which we have normally seen in the industry, have so far focused mainly on forest-based types of carbon credit creation. And that's been a lot of tribes throughout the United States and Alaska have entered into the cap and trade market. Under the initiative that I just mentioned, we are focusing on the voluntary carbon market. And that's a little bit different than the compliance market, which is the California cap and trade. But we believe that the voluntary market is going to be expanding and growing in the next decade. And we want to ensure that tribes are participating in that marketplace over the next 10 years or so, because right now I think they're projecting a $1 billion industry in 2021, which will grow to about $50 billion a year by 2030.
For the whole carbon credit trade business is going to be that high?
That's some of the projections that we're seeing by industry experts, especially after coming out of COP26 and the regulations and baselines that are being developed. So this industry is very complex. Again, one of the reasons why the National Indian Carbon Coalition was created in helping tribes develop the projects themselves, but also go through the process of understanding how these types of projects can benefit tribal lands, especially their tribal membership, by including new sort of what we call co-benefits of health and protecting culture, protecting traditional resources on tribal lands.
And Corbin, maybe you could talk about, I don't know if this, it sounds like Brian is, they have a very good program going here. What about the average farmer who's not a part of that program?
Well, I think the idea would be to, you know, to start setting a baseline for what the practices look like now. Brian would be the expert here to kind of answer this, but to start, you know, setting a baseline, establishing a baseline, and then the idea would be if you can demonstrate that you're sequestering more carbon, or if you're changing your practices in a way that reduces nitrous oxide emissions, for example, or methane emissions, that those could be sold perhaps under the voluntary offset market or else in the compliance market. So I think it's important to distinguish between the two. So what Brian was talking about was selling these permits or offsets in a voluntary market. And so there are firms and individuals. So if you buy an airline ticket, it gives you an option at the end usually to offset your carbon emissions. And that's exactly where this money would go. It would go to groups that are reducing emissions elsewhere outside of kind of a compliance framework, outside of a regulatory framework, and reducing their emissions so that if you're contributing to emissions, and if you're feeling like you want to do something about it, one way to do that would be to offset your emissions elsewhere.
And maybe, Brian, you could add to that?
Yeah, as Corbett says, you know, one of the areas that we are looking at is the voluntary market. And basically, it's going to be focusing on what we call the social responsible organizations, entities out there, businesses driving the direction of where this market is currently going. Government is always a little bit behind where enterprises are. So currently what we're seeing in the voluntary market is a lot of discussion and a lot of interest in carbon projects developed on indigenous lands throughout North America by organizations such as Amazon or Disney. General Mills has been really involved in what's going on, along with General Mills looking at agricultural projects. They're looking at trying to add more BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, People of Color producers into their portfolio. So they're not only helping develop these carbon projects, but they're buying the crops that are being generated on those lands as well. So there's a strong interest of what's occurring right now in the industry and working with Indigenous organizations. And again, I believe that tribes have a great opportunity here to take advantage of the marketplace and participate in the marketplace by not only deriving revenue, but leading the change that's going to be necessary for the future.
Talking today with Corbett Granger, Associate Professor of Ag and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. Brian Van Stippen is Project Director of the National Indian Carbon Coalition. Talking about carbon and the soil and transforming farmland with our two guests. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us. The email address is ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Mackenzie Crummy, our on-air producer today and producer Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Corbett Granger, Associate Professor in Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison, and also with us, Brian Van Stippen, Project Director of the National Indian Carbon Coalition. Taking your questions on carbon storage, policy, and farming, are you concerned about the level of carbon in our atmosphere? What do you think needs to happen for it to be lowered? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Let's take some calls. Dan in Bayfield County, we'll turn to you now. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. Every time I drive by a farm at nighttime, everyone has a yard light on. I'm curious what kind of impact that would have cutting down CO2 emissions if half the farmers would turn off their nightlights.
I don't know if we can answer that question. Corbett, a comment?
I don't have a number for that. My guess would be that the amount of electricity that's generated there, you know, even aggregated across all farms in Wisconsin, would be kind of small relative to the total emissions. But you know, that's an empirical question that I don't know the answer to.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Kevin in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there. I'm not really a huge farmer. I'm a organic vegetable gardener, and so I kind of know a little bit about farming. I'm driving around a lot of the large scale farmers here around Watertown. I'm seeing pretty huge areas of trees coming down to make more room, you know, for their farming. I mean, I see it on the road living on all around, and so that doesn't seem very carbon friendly to me. And so, I would say too that I suspect a lot of these farmers are farming on land that they rent. They're not even, you know, it's not really even their land. And if they're still taking these trees down, I know of one case that happened. And how can that be carbon neutral?
Well, thank you so much for calling, Kevin. Appreciate it. Well, we can get comments from both. Brian, do you want to start?
Yeah, certainly. Thanks for that question. And it is an issue that we see not only nationwide, but in Indian country as well. I'm a member of the Oneida Nation. There is a 160-acre parcel that I just drove by the other day. Like the caller said, the trees were all clear cut to put in new croplands. And that's some of the things that we're trying to avoid. We want to ensure that those trees are staying in the ground to protect and preserve those natural resources. And that's why we believe the carbon markets can be a benefit to those landowners. We also, as this caller pointed out, there is a secondary issue of who actually owns the carbon credits. Because if you're the producer that is leasing land, the carbon credits normally go to the landowner themselves, even if the producer is the one that is implementing the practices and putting in those opportunities to develop the carbon credits. So we are starting to see and have those discussions within the industry themselves to ensure that the producer is the one benefiting from the carbon credits, because they are the ones ultimately expending the dollars to implement the new practices, and therefore they should be the ones that benefit. It is a controversial issue right now, and again, it's being explored on how this can work and benefit both the landowner as well as the producer that is putting those sustainable management practices in place. But clear cutting the land to try to implement more cropland is one of the largest concerns that we see currently.
Yeah. Corbett, comment on that?
No, I think Brian did a great job answering that. Changes in land use are a big driver globally of greenhouse gas emissions, and obviously any deforestation is removing carbon sinks, and that's something that kind of goes counter to what we'd like to see. And this other point I think is great about incentives and ownership. So it's absolutely true that if you have somebody that's renting, somebody that's actually involved with the practices, you know, determining are they going to be growing cover crops, or you know, what type of tillage program do they have, use of fertilizers and so on. If we want to create the right incentives for carbon sequestration or soil sequestration, what we want to do is create the incentives for the people who are actually making those decisions, not just the landowners.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Ron in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. I wanted to talk about a global pitfall for this. I've already paid for 250 conifer seedlings to plant next spring or winter. I'll use me as an example, but this applies in the Amazon and Congo basins, Indonesia, Southeast Asia, every country on the planet except the ones that are going to get drowned in the Pacific. If I grow a conifer forest for 20 years and I've sold 200 tons of carbon storage to X corporation, and then we have a drought and a fire gets started, you know, 10 or 30 miles away from me, but the strong wind blows it right through, causes a crown fire on my tree plantation and burns up all the needles and all the twigs and even a lot of the trunks. Who has to pay for that? Does X Corporation continue paying me every year like they agreed, or do they take back the money for the previous 20 or 25 years? That's one thing. The other thing is during about 40 semester credits of soils and crops classes, we repeatedly would see a map of the United States with soil carbon superimposed. Okay, where they get a lot of rain along the Atlantic coast, there's a very low carbon percentage in the soil, and it increases as you get out into the Great Plains to eastern Colorado and Montana. Those areas with about 15 to 20 inches of rain produce, sequester the maximum organic carbon in their topsoils. And the map also shows that down by the Gulf of Mexico, with hot temperatures, high rainfall, very little organic carbon in the topsoils. But if you get up close to the Canadian border, it's like 2 to 3 times as much. So the West is where we can do this. The Ogallala Aquifer is being drained everywhere but in Nebraska. So all of those areas in Texas and Kansas should be converted from central pivot corn to native grasses that will survive with only 15 inches of rain.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, I think you've given us a lot to talk about there, Ron. Brian, maybe start with you.
Yeah, as the caller mentioned, and there is a lot to unpack there. It depended upon the area of the country that these projects are located. That's going to really determine what type of project you want to enter into on the lands themselves. Again, with the work that we do, working with the 574 federally recognized tribes in the United States, our goal is to help educate those tribal nations as to what type of carbon project they can do on their lands, what type of management practice they can instill, because every tribe is different. And that's where the work that we are doing, we are funded by the USDA through conservation innovation grants to help develop this data. And again, looking at the different areas of the country where these land bases are really going to be a significant interest on how we change the industry and develop these projects to ensure that we are addressing climate change. Because again, as the caller pointed out, the difference in land bases and soil carbon capture opportunities are different throughout the country.
Yeah. Corbett, a comment, I don't know if it's been worked out. He made an interesting comment about 100 acres of trees that he's getting paid by a company as carbon credits.
Right. Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And who pays? I'm not sure what the contracts look like. And I guess the contracts would dictate that. And also whether or not there's liability if there was negligence that caused the fire. But I think this raises two bigger questions about climate policy and offsets. One is kind of the problem of permanence that's related here. So if we're, converting land or if we're changing practices and putting more in carbon storage, in the form of, in his example, conifer forest, there is a real challenge that if we have a drought and if there's a fire that sparks, that all of that could go up in flames. And so there are issues of land management, trying to ensure that we're minimizing the risk of forest fires. But also, we need to kind of be cognizant of the fact that that all of these issues are going to be exacerbated by climate change, right? So more severe droughts, more, you know, would translate usually into higher risk forest fires. And so the issues of permanence of these offsets is also something that people raise.
Yeah, for sure.
And I just wanted to jump in there as well.
Yeah, go ahead, Brian.
And piggyback on Corbett, because on the, as he mentioned, within the development of the contracts for the sales of the credits, there is what we call a buffer pool, which is essentially an insurance policy for the success of the project. So if, for some reason, a forest fire or a drought were to make that project irrelevant in the future, that that buffer pool, that insurance policy, would still be able to cover the carbon credits that were sold up until that point in time. Mm-hmm. So fortunately, the landowner themselves would never have to reimburse any funds, with the exception if they sold those credits for 10, 15, 20 years in the future and were paid on the front end. And so that is another concern, a great point by the caller of some of the issues with the current marketplaces. But again, that's areas that we see that can be adapted, changed, amended here as we move forward within the industry itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really, really interesting. Brett in Cashton, let's go to you. Hi, Brett.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I missed the beginning of the show, so I was curious your guest's comments on some managed intensive grazing practices, restoring some of the carbon naturally to the soil. I have firsthand experience on some grazing farms that saw 10, 11, 12% organic matter. Is that going to be something that maybe we could see smaller farms thrive, as well as returning people to the land?
Hmm. Well, let's see. Brian, you want to start and then Corbin?
Yeah, certainly. Again, another great question by the caller. I'm glad that we're getting a lot of dialogue here today from people interested in this, because we have been working on a project with the Santa Ana Pueblo in New Mexico doing compost additions to their grazing lands. We've been dropping between a quarter to an inch of compost on certain parcels to help revitalize that soil to develop a stronger grazing parcel for the animals that are on that land. And we've so far shown that it can be successful scientifically. The problem is that we can't show success monetarily. It's a large expense to get that much compost to drop on the ground. But hopefully in the future, as the science and the data is being developed, the dollars will follow to help the provider, the producers, implement these new practices onto their lands.
Yeah. Corbett, anything to add there?
And I just agree that that was a great question, and I think it just underscores the fact that there are lots of opportunities for further reductions, and especially if we think about agriculture as kind of land use more broadly. You know, I think there are a lot of ways that we can reduce our carbon footprint through smarter management.
Yeah. Joe in Platteville, we'll go to you now. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I just want to use a little common sense here. I don't have studies to back this up, but if I look at a mature forest, which I have some on my property, and I can see a tree fall over and die, and a tree that rots away releases a similar amount of carbon as one that's burnt, and the leaves and stuff that fall to the ground also are, as they rot away. One of your other guests one time talked about they had their sauerkraut in the refrigerator and they could smell the sauerkraut fermenting, and that was a release in carbon. And so a mature forest really doesn't sequester much carbon, because it's almost given off as much as it's sequestering. The only stuff it would sequester would be the stuff that was put into the root system. And if you look at a mature forest land, and any land across America that had forest on it, the soils are rather thin. And so I would say, with common sense, think about the pasture land and the grazing of the buffalo or the grazing of the cattle. The cattle are eating the grass goes into the cow poops it out. Also, the cow tramples the grass, carbon, and the manure down into the soil. And if you look at the soil in a field that's been grazed, and you look at the microbes and the insect population and everything in there, it's going to be taking tons of carbon and just pulling it down into the soil and making soil. And consequently, all the deep soil in America is from grasslands. Soil can be built up about a sheet of paper at it every year if it's done correctly. And so my statement is, I don't have studies, I just have common sense to think, are we looking at this wrong at this forestation of stuff? Unless you actually harvest the log and take it in and make it into a chair, that it when it falls over and rots, it releases the carbon back into the atmosphere. So a mature forest does very little for us. So I guess I'd like some comments on that. That's just my take. I don't have any scientific data to back it up, but let's start using some common sense on this, on these discussions about carbon.
Yeah. Well, Joe, thank you so much. Brian, start with you.
Again, another great question and another controversial issue. Is the forest-based carbon projects compared to the soil-based carbon projects? As the caller mentioned, unless you're keeping those trees in the ground, they're not going to continue to store carbon. So that's always the goal with a forest-based carbon credit. What we are starting to see now within the industry is a push more towards these soil-based carbon projects, again, on grasslands, pasture lands, grazing lands, croplands. There's a lot more interest. There's a lot more carbon that is actually going to be sequestered on those types of lands. We work with a lot of different sampling organizations that drill down 30 centimeters to determine the carbon potential within those lands. And this is a new and emerging marketplace. There has not been a lot of projects developed on grasslands, but the organizations that we work with, such as the Arbor Day Foundation, the Nature Conservancy, American Forests, American Forest Foundations, all those nonprofits are now exploring and developing data and the science to look at how we can implement more soil-based carbon projects within the United States, because there is the belief that soil carbon has a lot more potential than forest-based carbon itself.
Mm, interesting. Corbett, anything to add there?
I agree with everything Brian just said. I think the caller raises a good question about the carbon cycle. And so, you know, there's the issue of if we have mature forests and trees are falling and trees are regrowing, that he's right that on net maybe we're not doing much. There is the issue of potential deforestation. So if we're reducing deforestation, you know, relative to some counterfactual world, you know, that is something that we should be taking into account. But I agree with Brian's larger point about looking at soils as kind of the next step.
Eric in Door County will give you a chance. Hi, Eric.
Good morning. My question actually goes towards property tax. Farmland property tax is extremely low, and my understanding is because it's based on corn prices compared to the actual land value. Yet forest land has recently, maybe not so recently, for some time now, has gone up in taxation, even if it's swampland trees, because it's considered recreation. So on one hand, you're taxing considerably higher forest land, swampland, and your farmland is maybe a tenth of what it would be taxed if it was based on actual land value instead of corn prices. So it seems like that's the wrong signal about keeping forest land. If you're encouraging people to cut down the trees and turn it into farmland, not only for the rent revenue, but also lower taxation.
Corbett, a comment?
Yeah, so I don't know about property tax rates in ag or how they're set, but I think the larger point about the overall tax system creating incentives is really important. You know, one way that we can think about creating good incentives is the use of conservation easements, and you can get kind of a tax reduction for putting your land into conservation easement, basically saying that you're not going to develop or you're not going to deforest that land. So we can use the tax code to create good incentives as well as bad incentives.
Mm. You know, Jim in Sauk County emailed that selling or trading carbon credits would at best only hold carbon emission levels where they are now. Paying farmers to engage in better farming practices that sequester more carbon does have merit. But he says industries that continue to emit carbon above accepted levels should not be allowed to buy credits. They should be fined. Brian, comment?
I definitely agree with that statement, and that's one of the issues that the industry is currently dealing with. We call that the allowing polluters to pollute concern. And some of the ways that we believe that can be addressed are ensuring that not only are these organizations adhering to and agreeing to adhere to sustainability development goals set by the United Nations, but then also to be audited on the back end as if they are purchasing the carbon credits to ensure that they are still implementing those other practices to be energy efficient, to reduce their emissions through other types of technology. We feel the carbon credit as an opportunity for landowners to derive revenue so that they could implement further type of energy reduction practices on their lands.
A listener in North Central Wisconsin emailed with a question. They've converted 25 acres of rolling farmland. It was non-native cool season grasses into now 18-year-old tall grass prairie. They've heard that the prairie grasses hold a great deal of carbon. Is this true?
That is an accurate statement. The hard part is on an acreage that small, that to do all of the testing and the development of a carbon project is going to be economically unviable. And again, one of the things that the industry is taking a hard look at is how do we get individual landowners that have the 20, 40, 80, 120 acres of land and are putting these practices in place, but they can't benefit. Again, it's what we try to call aggregation of landowners to come together, but it's a very difficult process. Like I mentioned with the Nature Conservancy, they have different programs for individual landowners to participate in with other landowners within that region. But it's a heavy lift to get those projects up off the ground. And then, of course, on the back end, that landowner may not see the dollar amount for the practices that they're implementing to want to continue in that program. So there's a lot of issues that are trying to be addressed at this point in time. And, you know, as the landowners continue to put these types of practices in place, the hope and the intent is that they'll be able to benefit economically down the road.
Jerry emailed that this conversation finds him at a crossroads. He's a Wisconsin dairy farmer. He's followed the industrial model his entire career. He read about regenerative ag and can see how far from this model his practices are. He's ready for a change. The question he has, can he feed his family and keep the farm profitable? Can he make the change and survive? There's no question in his mind. He lives and works in an explosive extractive industry. Is the support there for a farmer like him to thrive by doing the right thing?
I think that's a great question. I'll chime in here really quickly.
Sure.
So one of the challenges that we have right now is without a regulation in place, if we're going to have people like the caller who want to do the right thing, who want to maybe reduce emissions and reduce the carbon footprint of their business. But if it's not regulated, that's going to put them usually at a competitive disadvantage. Now, there are some negative cost actions that farmers or people in most industries can take, but that's not going to be enough to make a dent in overall climate change. And so what we really need is some aggressive federal policy so that it kind of levels the playing field for all of the regulated entities. You know, if we look to other places where they have aggressive climate policies, look to California or look to the European Union, we have all of those industries that are being regulated and still find it profitable to operate. But of course, the challenge is, absent any regulation, there's little incentive to take that action by yourself.
Yeah. Well, on that, maybe a last word, Brian. We're about running out of time here.
Yeah, quickly, I just wanted to mention, going back to the beginning of the conversation, so not only is the agricultural land important to look into, but also the food distribution systems. We are currently working with the Prairie Island Indian community in southeastern Minnesota. They're considered to be in a food desert. And by working with local producers to do a food distribution method to within tribal membership on those lands, and not only tribal membership, but the local communities, we're trying to ensure that we're not pulling food products from thousands of miles away reduce that distribution system. And then on top of it, we can create a carbon credit by doing that type of work. So we're in the initial stages of working with the Prairie Island Indian community on this project, but we believe it can be something that can be replicable for any community in the United States as we move forward to looking at how food is distributed within the United States itself.
And Jerry, I hope you'll shoot me an email. I may have some more, some other information that I could share with you down the road here. Appreciate your email and appreciate Corbin and Brian. It's been a great discussion. Thank you so much for being with us today. Perhaps we can do this again down the road. Really, thank you again so much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you much for having us today.
Corbett Granger, Associate Professor of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison, Brian Van Stippen, Project Director of the National Indian Carbon Coalition. Great questions and a couple of great guests, so appreciate it very much. And a couple of great guests coming up. Our weather guys next. I'm Larry Mueller.